I think we all recognize that with slightly different words, had a different title. It was called the Battle Hymn of the Republic. And it was the song that was sung so much during the Civil War days in America as the troops of the Union fought in their battle against the Confederacy of the South. A battle hymn is a song by which troops march to action or that calls attention to victories. Israel had its battle hymns. The words of one of them you know well. Saul has slain his thousands, and David his tens of thousands. And they would sing that battle hymn after the victories in which David was such a conquering hero for Israel. A battle hymn is usually a call to action. But the battle hymn that we're going to talk about today, the battle hymn of the Republic of Judah, was a hymn that was a call to unaction, a call to stand back from action. God has a way, when he fights his battles for his people, to use his own secret weapons. One time he used hail. Another time he used rats. Another time he used a plague. In the battle that we're going to speak of, God had a secret weapon, and it was a song. And that song is the battle hymn that we're going to speak of. Before we get into the battle itself, we want to go into a prophecy in the book of Joel very briefly, because it will lay the foundation for our battle hymn. It's found in the third chapter of Joel. We're going to read the first three verses. For behold, in those days and at that time, when I shall bring again the captivity of Judah and Jerusalem, I will also gather all nations and will bring them down into the valley of Jehoshaphat, and will plead with them there for my people and for my heritage Israel, whom they have scattered among the nations and parted my land. And they have cast lots for my people, and have given a boy for an harlot, and sold a girl for wine that they might drink. Largely because of the expression, I will gather all nations, we have traditionally, and I believe correctly so, identified the Valley of Jehoshaphat with the Battle of Armageddon that is found in Revelation 16, to which he gathers all nations. Not quite as popularly, but I think, again, properly so, we do well to identify it with the Battle of Zechariah 14, where he gathers all nations against Jerusalem to battle, and the forces that we see in Ezekiel 38 and 39. But here he uses a different analogy. He uses the analogy of the Valley of Jehoshaphat. It's an interesting analogy because scholars and Bible students are divided in their opinion as to what is the point of allusion and reference by this term, the Valley of Jehoshaphat. And there are four distinct answers that come to the forefront. And it's not the point of our study today to discard any of these answers as false. We'll mention them to give you a scope. We're going to only talk about one, but to give us the scope of the four answers. It is very popular among many to identify the term the Valley of Jehoshaphat with the Kidron Valley that is just outside of Jerusalem, separating Mount Moriah from the Mount of Olives. That is the Valley of Graveyards, Valley of Tombstones. It has become known traditionally as the Valley of Jehoshaphat. I never have been able to find out why, but it has had that traditional definition. And Brother Russell refers it to that, and he says, as that is a battle of tombstones, so this will be a final graveyard for the nations. And that is a nice analogy. A second body of thought says, no, don't look for any specific valley. Take the word itself and interpret the word. The Valley of Jehovah's Judgments. Because that's exactly what Joel was talking about. He brings the valley of decision into the valley of judgment. And there are Jehovah judges. The meaning of Jehoshaphat. Certainly the battle of Armageddon is the battle of Jehovah's judgments. But there's no historical basis for that. There are two battles that Jehoshaphat fights that do have historical bases that connect with New Testament prophecy. One of these is the battle described in 2 Kings 22, a battle in which Jehoshaphat unites with Ahab and goes to fight the kings of Syria as they come against Israel. And in this battle, there's false prophets that are involved, and the prophet Micaiah. And it begs identification with Revelation 16, where you've got a false prophet, you've got a battle of a union of three forces. There are Jezebel, Ahab, and Jehoshaphat. Here, the beast, dragon, and false prophet. Well, the identifications almost beg of similarity. And we think it is a battle well worthy of consideration. But none of those are the battles we're going to talk about. Those are prologue. The battle that we're going to refer to today is the battle that is recorded in 2 Chronicles, the 20th chapter. And let's turn together to 2 Chronicles 20 and get the picture of this battle, what's involved geographically, literally in the battle, and then come across and notice some applications from this battle to what we're discussing in our panel, trying to see the things that are coming to pass about us. 2 Chronicles 20, beginning in the first verse. It came to pass after this also that the children of Moab and the children of Ammon, and the next phrase is important, and with them others besides the Ammonites, came against Jehoshaphat to battle. Then there came some that told Jehoshaphat, saying, There cometh a great multitude against thee from beyond the sea on this side Syria, and behold, they be in Hatzatzon Tamar, which is En Gedi. The primary force in this battle that was coming against Israel was a force that was combined of Moab and Ammon, and with them an undefined coalition of others. We're going to find one of the coalition forces mentioned a little later. But at this stage, there was a coalition supporting Moab and Ammon. Now, Moab and Ammon are, if you're going to locate them today, central southern Jordan. They lie between Ammon, which takes its name from Ammon, on down to the area of Petra, the rose-red city that was the ancient Seir, the capital of Edom, but just north of that was Karnak, the capital of Moab. So it's that mountainous region just south of Mount Jordan. These forces had crossed over north somehow of Jericho. They had come down the west bank of the Dead Sea down to almost the southern tip where the En Gedi Valley comes in. En Gedi is the valley that was very fertile where David hid so many years from King Saul. It's got waterfalls, enough food there to feed an army, and it was a good place to locate the encampment for this battle. It's into this scene that Jehoshaphat is precipitated. Now, Jehoshaphat reacts when he sees this force, far outnumbering the Judaic force. He reacts with probably the same reaction that you and I would have. He panics. He goes to his knee in prayer. He utters a beautiful prayer from verses 3 to 13. And as is so typical, he blames God. He says in verse 9, And now behold, the children of Ammon and Moab and Mount Seir, whom thou wouldest not let Israel invade when they came out of the land of Egypt, but they turned from them and destroyed them not, how they reward us to come to cast us out of thy possession which thou hast given us to inherit. Oh, God, why did you in the first place let us stop them? We wouldn't have this trouble. But you wouldn't let us. And in Deuteronomy 2, that's right. God would. He said, that land is protected. You can't take them out of there. You leave them there. They were not part of the dispossessed tribes inhabiting the promised land. And so he puts it before the Lord and said, you give us the trouble, you get us out of it. The Lord chooses a different agent. He doesn't choose one of the standard prophets that may be on the scene at the time. He chooses a singer to deliver his message to Israel. A man by the name of Jehaziel. You read this in verse 14. Then upon Jehaziel, and here you've got a whole genealogy, traces who Jehaziel is, the son of Zechariah, the son of Benaiah, the son of Jeiel, the son of Mattaniah, a Levite of the sons of Asaph, came the Spirit of the Lord in the midst of the congregation. So we're just going to say Jehaziel of Asaph, an Asaphite. Asaph is a name you probably recognize from the Psalms. There are 21 Psalms of Asaph in the Bible. When King David organized the worship of Israel in reorganizing and planning for the temple services, he organized 24 courses of singers. And he divided these into 8 courses. And he had a head over each course. One of the heads was from the tribe of Kohath, one was from the tribe of Merari, and one was from the tribe of Gershon. These 3 heads were named Ethan, Asaph, and Korah. And you'll find 21 Psalms of Asaph, something like 13 Psalms of Korah, and 2 Psalms of Ethan that go through the Psalms of David. Now, these Psalms were not necessarily written by Asaph, Ethan, and Korah, but they're written by their descendants. They're written by those who occupied the seat of Asaph, or Korah, or Ethan, at the particular time when they were written. So he approaches this Asaphite. Hearken ye, all Judah, this is God's message through him, and you inhabitants of Jerusalem, and thou King Jehoshaphat, thus saith the Lord unto you, be not afraid nor dismayed by reason of this great multitude, for the battle is not yours, but God's. He's starting to set the tone for how God plans to fight this particular battle. Tomorrow, go down against them. Behold, they come up by the cliff of Ziz. The cliff of Ziz is just south of En Gedi. It's not too far from ancient Zoar, where a Lot encamped. And you shall find them at the end of the brook, before the wilderness of Jeruel. But you won't need to fight in this battle. Set yourselves, stand still, and see the salvation of the Lord. With you, O Judah and Jerusalem, fear not nor be dismayed. Tomorrow go out against them, for the Lord to be with you. Notice the contrast? Go out against them, but don't go out to fight. Go out to stand still. I want you to go out. You're provoked to battle. I want you to restrain. You're used to fighting back. This time, don't fight. You just go out there, expose yourselves. And you just watch what's going to happen. And Jehoshaphat bowed his head with his face to the ground. I guess I'd do the same. Impossible. And all Judah and the inhabitants of Jerusalem fell before the Lord, worshiping the Lord. And the Levites of the children of the Kohathites and of the children of the Korahites stood up to praise the Lord of Israel with a loud voice on high. And they, well, that's these Korahites and the Kohathites, which is the Asaph group, they rose up early in the morning and went forth into the wilderness of Tekoa. And as they went forth, Jehoshaphat stood and said, Hear, O Israel, Judah, and the inhabitants of Jerusalem. Believe in the Lord your God, so shall ye be established. Believe his prophets, so shall ye prosper. Get the picture. The singers have gone in front. They are in a battle scene with a great force arrayed against Israel, singing. It's a ridiculous defense. Unless you really sing like I sing. But it's really not the way to win a battle. So they stand around and they sing. Now, the Lord enters in. And when he had consulted with the people, he appointed the singers unto the Lord that they should praise the beauty of holiness. Then he went out before the army and said, Praise the Lord, for his mercy endureth forever. And when they began to sing, people sing, the singers sing, the army sings. This is the battle hymn. that Judah is carrying into this battle. And when they began to sing and to praise, then the Lord sent ambushments against the children of Ammon, Moab, and Mount Seir, which were come against Judah, and they were smitten. So the Lord set the ambushments. There was an ambush hiding there. Now, the Jewish rabbis say it's the angels who were hiding. Scratch that one. The Bible tells you clearer who the hiders were, who was set in ambush. But notice now we've got a third force. Mount Seir is joined with Moab and Ammon. They had come as a helper in this battle. Mount Seir is Edom. So you've got Moab, Adam, Ammon, and Edom. You're just continuing your strip of Jordan, going down. From Ammon, going down to the area south of Mount Nebo, Karnak, and then going down now to Mount Seir. That's your source. But there's others with them, unidentified. Who sets the ambushment? Verse 23. For the children of Ammon and Moab stood up against the inhabitants of Mount Seir, utterly to destroy, and destroy them. And when they had made an end of the inhabitants of Seir, then everyone helped to destroy each other. He set the enemy against the enemy. The ambushments that were set were not Jew against Arab. The ambushments were Arab against Arab. He set their own forces. This coalition that had come broke apart. Edom started fighting with Moab and Ammon. Now, we don't know where the rest of the coalition was involved. We just know that they were there. We'll find out later who the others of the coalition were. But at this stage, we see that there's internal disharmony. And out of this internal disharmony, once they settle their dispute, by this time they're so confused they're fighting each other, and they just wipe each other out. And Israel sits back, and they're just singing the whole time. It's their weapon. It's a beautiful victory. There's one more unusual thing about this battle, but I think we'll come back to that little aspect later. Now, what would be interesting to know is, what did they sing? What were the words of that song that were so effective? And there are clues that I think we can pretty well speculate exactly the words of the song that they sung in that day, the song that was that secret weapon that worked so powerfully in winning the battle of Jehoshaphat. Let me point to the clues. And then we're going to go to the Psalms and try to identify which psalm was written on this occasion by Jehaziel. What is the psalm of Jehaziel and what is its effect in that battle? And how does it relate to the overall Valley of Jehoshaphat? Notice first, number one, it is a battle of Moab and Ammon primarily. The rest of the coalition is there, but they're only there to help Moab and Ammon. Moab and Ammon are the primary movers. Notice second, the writer of the song is of the house of Asaph. It's Jehaziel of Asaph that writes the psalm. Notice third, that in the psalm, the reason why Israel is so concerned is in verse 11. The Moab and Ammon want to cast us off out of our possession that thou hast given us to inherit. The burden of the song is that our enemies have come to cast us off from the inheritance we've given. Those form the three basic clues we want to look at. Moab and Ammon are the prime movers. The psalm was written by Asaph, or one of his followers, and the psalm relates to the casting off of Israel from their inheritance. There are 21 psalms that Asaph writes. So that narrows our search. We can go through each of them, try to find clues. But one of these stands out immediately above the others. And in the panel, this was briefly mentioned. Turn with me now, if you will, to the 83rd Psalm. Psalm 83. And we want to notice three factors in Psalm 83 to get the historic background for this particular psalm. First, look at the title of the psalm. A song or psalm of Asaph. This is one of the Asaph psalms. Secondly, in describing the coalition of the psalm, just quickly turn to verse 8. Asher is joined with them. They have helped the children of Lot. If you go back earlier, you'll find that Moab and Ammon are prime movers in the song this is. But the whole movement of the song is to help the children of Lot. The children of Lot were two, Moab and Ammon. This song was sung over a battle that was fought to help the children of Lot by a coalition that included Edom and others. Three, the Chronicles reference tells us the purpose of the song is because this coalition came to cast them off from their inheritance. And if you read verse 4 in the psalm, it says, "They have said, come, let us cast them off from being a nation, that the nation of Israel may be no more in remembrance." So there are three tie-ins of this psalm with that battle. Therefore, we are suggesting that Psalm 83 is the battle hymn that was sung in the Valley of Jehoshaphat and has a particular reference to the greater Valley of Jehoshaphat battle, the Battle of Armageddon. As Brother Tony mentioned his comments in the panel, there seems to be a lot of commentary in the past few months about the appropriateness of Psalm 83 to the current world situation and the developments prior to the Battle of Ezekiel 38. I'm going to begin this next part of the discussion with a very firm position. I'm going to borrow some words out of Eugene Burns' mouth a week ago. It's an opinion where I stand firmly with a foot on each side of the fence. There are problems in interpreting this psalm, and I'm not here to solve all the problems. I can't. But as we look at this psalm, and as we begin to overplay it upon the present and the prospective future, I think the broad lines we'll see. There are some problem areas, I want to admit that, just as soon as we get started into the psalm, because there are some areas that I certainly puzzle about as I look at this, and we're sharing thoughts one with another. Let's go back to the psalm now and pick up one minor point before we get into the psalm. We looked at the title. We did look at the subscription. That's at the very bottom of the psalm. To the chief musician upon Gittith. That subscription upon Gittith appears in three psalms. Only three. One by Ethan, one by Korah, and one by Asaph. Each of the main dividers of the singers of psalm have a Gittith psalm. Gittith is a word in Hebrew that means the winepress. It's a winepress psalm. Tradition says that being a winepress psalm, it was sung on the grape harvest every year, these three psalms, and that was the Feast of Tabernacles, the Feast of Deliverance. So it is a psalm of deliverance. Well, that's precisely what we find in 2 Chronicles 20. This was a song of deliverance. Stand still and let the Lord fight your battle. It's His battle. Verse 1, "Keep not thou silence, O God. Hold not thy peace. Be not still, O God. For lo, thine enemies make a tumult, and they that hate thee have lifted up the head. They have taken crafty counsel against thy people and consulted against thy hidden ones. They have said, come and let us cut them off from being a nation, that the nation of Israel may be no more in remembrance. For they have consulted together with one consent. They are confederate against thee." Almost identical to Jehoshaphat's prayer. You could just superimpose the prayer of Jehoshaphat in 2 Chronicles 20 over this, and you've got the same thought pattern run through. Our backs are to the wall. We need help. This is the plot line that's there. Now, we begin to get an identification of that little mysterious phrase in 2 Chronicles 20, verse 1, and others with them. Here we have a more complete identification of the coalition. They are confederate against thee, the tabernacles of Edom and the Ishmaelites, of Moab and the Hagarenes, Gebal and Ammon and Amalek, the Philistines with the inhabitants of Tyre. Aser also was joined with them. They have hopen the children of Lot, Selah. Unfortunately, our map is very small, but we're going to try to verbally enlarge the map for you a little bit so you can get the perspective as we try to locate these. We want to notice in locating these tribes two things. This is not, and I want to emphasize the word not, this is not an inclusive list of all Arab peoples. It's a very specifically itemized list of certain Arab peoples. And second, we need to admit that scholars do not all agree where these place names fit. They do on many, they do not agree on all of them. So let's move over to our map here. Basically, the area we're going to touch, you've got Israel, the little brown area you can see here. I hope you can see here. Jordan is the blue-gray area, reaching over to Iraq. This is why the Iraq-Jordanian coalition was so essential in the current conflict, was so that if Iraq chose to have access against Israel, they would have the right of way through Jordan. Here we find many Arab tribes in Saudi Arabia, both then and today. Here we find Syria to the north, Lebanon, and the many Arab tribes that are there. There are forces that are aligned with them traditionally over in Egypt in this area, and then down in this area you had the biblical Sheba and Dedan, and the effect they play later in prophecies. Okay, let's notice where these tribes lived. The tabernacles of Edom were right here in southern central Jordan, around today's Petra. The Ishmaelites, generally ascribed to being the Bedouin, are very nomadic, and it's extremely hard to place them. But most of the scholars place them as a nomadic people who would take some of their year over in Israel, but most of it in this leg of Jordan, heading out because there were several oases striving between Ammon and the Iraqi border. And therefore, that was the largest area of the Ishmaelites. Moab, very positively identified as being the area at the north end of the Dead Sea and the Jordanian side in Jordan. The Hagarenes is probably the most difficult to establish, because when you have Ishmael, who have you got left for Hagar? We only know of Ishmael as being a son of Hagar. It implies that there were other children of Hagar, and most scholars will place them either in the northern edge of Saudi Arabia through here, or in the very southern edge of Jordan through here. Right along this borderline of Jordan and Saudi Arabia appears to be the area of the Hagarenes. Gebal, there are two definitions. There are those who favor the Gebal, which is up in the area of Gilead, but most authorities say it is the Gebal that is near Baalbek in Lebanon, just north of Beirut, the tall mountain just north of Beirut in Lebanon. Ammon, no problem. Ammon, Jordan, still has the same name. In the capital of Jordan, the area here in the northern part of Jordan. Amalek was a tribe that inhabited usually the northern Negev, or the northern Sinai, rather, near the Gaza Strip. You remember when Israel came out of the Exodus, the first battle they fought, when Hur held up the hands of Aaron, was against the Amalekites. They were down in that area. The Philistines dwelt in two places. They dwelt besides the Isle of Cyprus. They dwelt around Ashdod and Ashkelon in Israel, in the Gaza Strip, and in the southern end of Lebanon, just south of Tyre and Sidon. The inhabitants of Tyre today is destroyed, but Sidon, his sister city, is there as the headquarters of the Palestinians. And who do we have left? And Assur is joined with them. Assur is not Syria. We must be careful to always distinguish between Syria and Assyria. Syria historically had its capital in Damascus and corresponds to Syria today. Assyria had its capital in Nineveh, Baghdad today, Iraq, particularly to the area of the Tigris Euphrates. But this area of Iraq was joined with them. So now let's pull together what we've seen. We've got a coalition that covers almost all of Jordan, Jordan-based, with Iraq, with northern Sinai and southern Lebanon tied in. Northern Sinai and southern Lebanon are your home today, the Palestinians. So basically, it's a coalition, not of Arab nations as such, but of Jordan, Iraq, and the Palestinians. Not too awfully dissimilar to the coalition that we just faced in the 100-hour battle this past year. I'm not saying this applies there. I'm just saying the coalition is similar. We have a similar coalition to those forces. We do not have Saudi Arabia, any of the tribes that were there in this coalition. We do not have Syria in this coalition. They are not mentioned. He is specifically looking at a very localized coalition in this battle as he talks about it. So this tends to connect. I want to make my next statement clear so I'm not misinterpreted. It is very tempting to link Psalm 83 with what we've seen in the last month and a half, 2 months. I don't know that we have the authority to do so. There are enough differences to make that linkage problematic. But it's worthy enough of consideration to notice those things that do favor the linkage. That may start our train of thought. So we're looking at, and looking at the things favoring a linkage of this psalm with the events is not a final interpretation, but enough to set a base to work from. We see a coalition of nations extremely similar to the coalition that was established by Hussein in his battle this time with the coalition of the West. We see Israel enticed into the battle, but restraining from the battle. We see as a result the victory given to Israel without their fighting. We see the victory by Arab being turned against Arab. But remember, the Arab that was turned against was Jordan against Jordan, and that's not true in this other picture. So I'm not trying to make a full linkage here. Just recognize that. We see one more rather interesting parallel that we just want to pass in the amendment, going back to 2 Chronicles 20. That wasn't an awfully long battle. You know how long that battle lasted back there? 100 hours. Would you believe? Not quite. It isn't quite that. It's very close, about 96 hours. It's just a little bit shorter. And that is found in 2 Chronicles 20:26. And on the fourth day, they assembled for the victory song. So it was about 4 days long, about 96 hours. So you got almost the identical length of battles. That probably is pure coincidence. But it's just interesting to note as we look at the linkages between the two. So there are a lot of linkages. Now let's look at the dissimilarities. This doesn't mean the battle doesn't apply. It just means you need to look at the whole picture. So let's look at the dissimilarities between the two. Psalm 83, verse 8, Assur is joined with them. They have helped the children of Lot. If you or I were going to describe the conflict that we've just seen, we'd say the children of Lot are joined with them. They're going to help Assur. The children of Lot were the assistants. Assyria was the aggressor. Here, Moab and Ammon was the aggressor. Assyria was the assistant. So the horse is on the shoes on the wrong foot. That's the analogy I wanted to use. You got a problem there. Maybe not. The problem may be more apparent than real. Because what is never too apparent in reading current events is what's going on behind the scenes. The obvious point here was either A, oil, B, jealousy over Kuwait, C, accusations that Kuwait was undermining the Iraqi fields, D, a one-man claim to power, or E, one of the things that came in, linkage of the Palestinian question. That never was far from the scene. Linkage was always there in the background. Was linkage the tail or was it the head? We're too close to the scene to know. We don't know where linkage fit in of the Palestinian question. We don't know to what extent Jordan was sitting back passively saying, yes, we will help Assyria, or to what extent Assyria was saying, yes, we'll take your position and we'll head up the move for the Palestinians. That's an unknown. I don't know. I don't think any of us know. That's part of the politics that's still hidden clearly from our eyes. But what we are seeing up to this point is amazing similarities that back up one kernel of thought. Here is a coalition of nations, 10 nations, primarily Arabic and Semitic. Not all. Philistines were Hamitic. There are Hamitic nations involved, but primarily Semitic. The Hamitic tend to be the ones identified to the Palestinians in this coalition. Ezekiel 38, you've got a coalition of seven nations, no Semitic unless Sheba and Dedan are the Semitic Sheba and Dedan. That's a minor point. But basically, you've got two different areas of linkages. So it seems to be two different fronts, two different battles. How does this relate to the overall picture? During the intermission, I was saying that under the phrase that Brother Rick ended with, what manner of persons ought ye to be, that one of the answers is flexible. That as we realize and see events materializing, we sometimes need to realize, well, I didn't quite see this right. I need to move a little bit. I used to be a very strong stander that Psalm 83 and Ezekiel 38 were the same battle to different fronts. I've changed my mind. I was wrong. It's as simple as that. As the events have materialized, I began to see that that was not a good, firm footing. But now, I want to tell you why I thought that. Because it brings us into the larger picture. Verse 8 of Psalm 83 ends with the word Selah. That is your typical meaning word that uses ending one section, starting anew, and it's saying, stop, consider what you heard, this relates to what I'm going to say. It's a reflexive, it's a connector. It's a link in a chain. It's linking two separate but related thoughts. So now we're going to the related thoughts. Up to verse 8, he's describing what's happening. From verse 9, he's describing what he would like to happen afterwards. Do unto them as unto the Midianites, as to Sisera, as to Jabin, at the brook which perisheth Endor, they became as dung for the earth. Make their nobles like Oreb and Zeb, and all the princes of Zeba and Azamuna, who said, and notice verse 12 in connection with 2 Chronicles 20, let us take to ourselves the houses of God in possession. That same word that was picked up as the theme word of the song from Chronicles. He picks up two Old Testament historic battles. He could pick up any battles he wanted. He chooses two as the battles that he's going to use to describe his ideal end. Both of these battles have two things in common. Neither of these battles had anything to do with Moab or Ammon. Both were against Midian, totally different tribe. And second, both of these battles were Megiddo battles. These are battles that are centered at Megiddo. I want to emphasize that because Ezekiel 38, I think, can be very established as being a part of the Megiddo, Armageddon picture. Therefore, I said, Psalm 83 cannot be preceding because its analogy is Megiddo. It's a Megiddo analogy. It's got to be Megiddo. But why these two battles? The two battles happen in the opposite ends of Megiddo. Megiddo controls a plain, the plain of Esdraelon. The entrance from the Mediterranean Sea is through the pass of Mount Carmel. And that's where the battle with Sisera took place. It took place following the mountainside on up to Hazor in the north by the Sea of Galilee. The second invasion, the invasion of Gideon that's referred to, went all the way Transjordan, almost up to the Syrian border. It ended way over at a place called Ramoth-Gilead of Gad. And that's where they trapped Ziba, Zalmunna, Oreb, and Zeb. These four princes that led that battle were trapped over there. So I think he's giving us a general picture of Megiddo. But I want to stress the second picture, because it's the one that relates to Jehoshaphat. The battle of Gideon connects Megiddo with Ramoth-Gilead of Gad. It's a battle that begins in Megiddo and ends in Ramoth-Gilead. It begins right about here. This is where the battle starts. But they chase the foe so far, they don't catch him until he's way over here. It's up in this area here where they finally catch them at Ramoth-Gilead. And that's where the victory is obtained. Now that may not seem like much. So let's come down to another analogy and try to draw this into the picture toward the closing. Megiddo is important to us because of Revelation, the 16th chapter. Now, got a few little simple questions to ask here about Megiddo. Let me read the passage. Revelation 16, 16. And he gathered them to a place called in the Hebrew tongue Armageddon. Armageddon is a word that we usually assume, and correctly assume, to mean the mountain of Megiddo. It's got some problems. Megiddo has no mountains. Megiddo lies in a plain, in a very flat plain. It's at the southern end of the plain of Esdraelon. But it controls the mountain passes that go into the Galilee. And the whole plain forms a place to rally the troops and get them in line. So it was a garrison city to control that pass. Megiddo became a mountain. That seems odd. The plain actually, literally, was transformed into a mountain. Because being a strategic city, it was often overthrown in battle. And rather than go to the trouble of hauling away all the rubbish, they just piled dirt on top and built the next city on top. And then they piled dirt on top of that and built the next city on top. And they got 21 cities now. 21 layers they've discovered going down. And there's a mountain. Literally, Folger brought a mountain. The men brought a mountain to Megiddo. It was the mountain of man's inhumanity to man. 21 layers thick. It reminds you of I will overturn, overturn, overturn three times. How thoroughly, thoroughly, seven times each. Three times seven. It was a complete overturning. But the mountain pass that it controlled to the north controlled the famous Via Damaris, the highway of the sea, by which all of the troop forces would come. And that pass was so narrow that in the Apocrypha, in the book of Judith, it says it was so narrow that only two people could pass through at a time. That narrow was the pass. So they had complete control of this pass. That's why it was such an important strategic battleground, such a strategic site. Megiddo, Armageddon. How do you spell Megiddo? M-E-G-I-D-D-O. How do you spell Armageddon? A-R-M-A-G-E. No. That's how King James spells it. Look in your Diaglots. Armageddon is spelled in the Diaglots in all manuscripts with one D, not two Ds. It's only in your King James they pick it up because they immediately think McGittle. We want to go to the blackboard. We're going to do a little wandering down a side trail and try to bring this in because I think it will finish our lesson very well on why the battle he chose is the battle he chose. Trivia question. What United States city, over 1 million population, has the longest name? Pennsylvania, that's good. Well, it's not a city. Philadelphia would be a good choice. No, the name is only 2 letters long, L.A. What's the name of the largest city in California? If you say Los Angeles, you're wrong. Because Los Angeles is not the name of Los Angeles. Let me give you the name, the true name of the city seal of Los Angeles. It's La Reina de los Ángeles de los Cielos. Try putting that on a postage stamp. They didn't want to. It said, the Queen of the Angels of Heaven. So they said, get rid of it all and just take it, the angels. And so they just took the angels out and made Los Angeles. That was too long, so they made it L.A. People do this with names. It's common. Let me give you a name in ancient Israel. A name that's even worse than Los Angeles. A name of the city we've been talking about. Ramoth. Gilead of Gad. Now, if you write a lot of letters, you're going to want to shorten the name too. So they did. It was just too long a name to keep using. They did the same thing Los Angeles did. They said, let's cut all that stuff out and let's just make it Ramoth. And in much of the Old Testament record, you read about Ramoth. Ramoth appears time and again. But they had a problem. There were three Ramoths. There was a Ramoth in Gad, there was a Ramoth in Naphtali, and there's a Ramoth in Benjamin. So they had to add on the suffix Ramoth Gad. Otherwise, you wouldn't know which one you were talking about. This went on for several hundred years. Then as you read the Bible records and historical records, the name gets shortened again. In fact, all the Ramoths do, about the same time. They get shortened to the very simple Rama. And you recognize that name from the Bible. It comes up frequently. This was Rama of Gad. Let's follow our history lesson down just a little further. Babylon conquers. Babylon is overthrown. Medo-Persia conquers. Medo-Persia is overthrown. Greece conquers. Greece is overthrown. Rome doesn't quite conquer. Rome conquers the world, but they leave 10 cities in Palestine under Greek influence. And they acknowledge this. They give them a Greek name covering the whole 10. You'll find it in the New Testament. The Decapolis. The 10 cities. One of these cities was Ramoth of Gad. Ramoth of Gad. So now we have to identify, this is the Greek Rama. The problem is, the Greeks don't call Greek, Greek. The Greek calls it Java. The Latins don't call the Greek Yavan, they call it Ionia. So the Latin name that they would use in Jesus' day was Ramoth of Gad of Ion. The Ionic, the Greek Ramoth of Gad. That was the name in New Testament times for this city. Generally, occurred with. Okay, let's leave the board for a second. Go to another trivia question. When Jesus died on the cross, he was buried in a rich man's tomb. A man by the name of Joseph What city did Joseph come from? Arimathea. We all know that, and it's wrong. Arimathea is what it's called by the Greeks. But if you find Arimathea in a Jewish atlas, you're going to find it Ramathea. The Greeks had a problem. The Latins had a problem with the AR combination. Whenever you transliterate an AR combination, an RE combination, because of the language, it gets changed to the AR. Ramathea becomes Arimathea, and Ramagad becomes Arma. Gad. Armageddon with one D. Now, this doesn't take away from the other definition. The other is very true. Megiddo is where it starts. Armageddon is where it ends. It covers the whole spectrum. He chooses an analogy that connects the two towns that both identify with that mystery word, Armageddon. He makes a code word, but he's leaving the one D in. So what we have here, then, is a picture of Armageddon, not as a single battle, but Armageddon is a war in which various battles take place. And in this war that begins with the coalition of Psalm 83, it doesn't end to get to the coalition of Ezekiel 38. You're covering a larger spectrum in the whole picture. Where do we stand? I don't know. It's too close to the trees to see the forest. It's hard to identify. But there are enough identifying symbols to say we stand very close. There is enough similarities between current world events that maybe there needs to be reshuffling and some more reassertions of more events that we haven't seen yet. I don't know. But it looks like we are very close in the development of phase one leading into the battle. The battle that starts with the chasing of Orev and Zeb and Zalmunna. That will end in the final battle with the destruction of Oreb, Zeb, and Zalmunna over at Ramoth Gilead of Gad, Armageddon of the 1D. Let's go back in closing to our 83rd Psalm. Starting at verse 12. Well, verse 12 we covered. That was repeating the purpose of the psalm. Let us take the house of God in possession. O my God, make them like a wheel, and as a stubble before the wind. As the fire burneth the wood, and as the flame setteth the mountains in fire, so persecute them with thy tempest, and make them afraid with thy storm. Two analogies. A wheel and a fire stubble. A wheel was invented because man needs something to go round and round. It turns. And every time it goes round and round, that which was on bottom gets on top, and that which was on bottom goes to the top, goes to the bottom. And we have a word for that. We call it a revolution. And that's what he's saying. Let there be a revolution. That's one of the analogies he's using. Let there be a revolution. Let it be a wheel. Let it be a cyclic event. Here you've got a cycle. Let there be a revolving. Let it be as a fire of stubble. This fire of stubble is described in great detail in Obadiah, the 17th verse. And it fleshes out the other area of the picture to give us the whole valley, whole picture of how God defeats his foes at this time. Obadiah 18th verse. And the house of Jacob shall be a fire, and the house of Joseph a flame, and the house of Esau for stubble. And they shall kindle in them and devour them, and there should not be any remaining of the house of Esau, for the Lord has spoken it. From one aspect, Israel will stand back, the battle is the Lord's. From another aspect, the Lord will fight through Israel. And through Israel will come the victory over these nations. They're just looking at different aspects. Let them be confounded, or fill their faces with shame. And you notice the next phrase occurring in Ezekiel 38 and 39, that they may seek thy name, O Lord. Let them be confounded and troubled forever. that they put to shame and perish. Why? That men may know that thou, whose name alone is Jehovah, art the Most High over all the earth. And that's the real purpose for the Battle of Armageddon. That's the real purpose for Jacob's trouble, is to demonstrate that God is God.
Thank you, Brother Carl, for that very interesting description of the battle hymn of Judah. It took a lot of midnight oil to look into these derivations. May the Lord bless you. And Brother Carl will close with a word of prayer, also ask a blessing upon our fellowship and evening meal.
Our Heavenly Father, we are thankful for all things, especially for the knowledge that beyond the uncertain troubles that lay ahead of us is the certainty of thy kingdom and the blessings that will contain. And for that, Father, we do continue to earnestly desire and to pray. Bless our fellowship, Father, as we part from this meeting, that we may be stimulated by the thoughts of thy word, may be stimulated by the fact that we're living in great and wondrous times. May this fellowship be pervasive through our evening discussions, through the meal, or the temporal food that you have provided will refurbish the outer man and the fellowship the inner, so that together they may use this strength to redound to thy glory. To that end, we leave ourselves in your care and keeping. In Jesus' name.